Welcome, dear hunters, managers, and enthusiasts. This is Deer University, the podcast of the Mississippi State University Deer Lab. My name is Bronson Strickland.
And I'm Steve Damaris. Bronson and I are professors of wildlife management and co-directors of the MSU Deer Lab. Together, we've researched deer across the United States for more than 40 years. In our podcasts, we explain the why and how of deer management based on science. Whether it's research we've conducted or explaining research done elsewhere, we'll offer you a college course in the science of deer management.
But don't let Steve scare you. This isn't going to be a review of calculus or chemistry. Instead, we take results of research, reduce it to what's important, and explain how you can apply research to management. So join us for this episode of Deer University. Welcome back to Deer University. Today we have another exciting episode. Steve, a few episodes ago we talked about culling and the folly of culling, when it works, when it doesn't. Mainly it doesn't work for genetic purposes, but you can use it in terms of managing the standing crop and things like that we went into a lot of detail before. Right after we recorded that episode, and as I was eating supper, I turned it to one of the outdoor channels. I don't know if it was outdoor channel, but one of those sporting channels. And an issue came on, a program came on, and they were in Texas. And either the wildlife manager or the owner of the ranch, I can't remember, said they had this outstanding management plan that had been going on for years and years, and that they were in the process of getting rid of, quote, that 8-point gene in their population.
They were managing genetics.
They thought they were managing genetics.
Yeah.
But they're not. So evidently they didn't listen to our podcast. Let's assume that it was pre-recorded the previous fall and they haven't had a chance to listen
That's right.
to the podcast yet. But genetics is a topic that is ever-present. It's pervasive. No matter how much we write, talk, and try to stamp it out, it doesn't seem like we can. We're going to talk a little bit about genetics today from a population and regional standpoint. Today we have with us a special guest, Mr. Chad Dacus. Chad was formerly the deer coordinator as well as the wildlife bureau chief for the Mississippi Department of Wildlife, Fisheries, and Parks. And Chad, during your tenure, you listened to the public, you and your staff and the biologists, and there was a lot of concern and maybe sometimes outcry that within Mississippi, because we see such a disparity regionally in the size of bucks, from the southern part of the state to the delta region of the state, we see a huge disparity in antler size, body size, etc. And a lot of people were thinking that this is a genetic consequence, that genetically these deer from the southern part of the state, they're just programmed to be a lot smaller. And so, Chad, I'm going to pitch it to you. If you don't mind, maybe give us just a few minutes, a little bit about yourself and what you did at MDWFMP, and then tell everybody about MDWFMP's perspective on what was going on with this project, and actually why y'all decided to invest in a project like this, a long-term project.
Thanks, Bronson. I appreciate the opportunity to come talk with you today and to talk with everybody who's listening to this podcast. I've been listening, kind of catching up on what y'all been doing on here as well, and I hope that everybody, you know, tunes in each week and downloads a new podcast. I think there's going to be a lot more information to come from the Deer University. But a little bit about my background. I was with the Mississippi Department of Wildlife, Fisheries, and Parks for about 14 years. During that time period, I was the deer program coordinator for about 6 years, and then was assistant chief and chief of the Wildlife Bureau for a few years after that. It seems like that entire time period was dealing with this one research project too, which is kind of amazing when you think about it. And, you know, we started this research project in around 2004, 2005, and at that point, we had been in Mississippi under the 4-point rule for about 10 years. That all started about 1990, actually started in the fall of 1995. And so at that point, you know, 2005, about 10 years later, we had our hunting public across the state some of them were saying, hey, we've been on what they consider to be a quote-unquote big buck program because they've been on a four-point rule, even though we all know that's not really a big buck program. It's just it's more of an age management program, a beginning level of an age management program.
And, Chad, at that time, the four-point rule in Mississippi, it wasn't 4 points on one side.
That's right. It's for four total points. And so it was 4 points, whether there were three on one, 3-1, 2-2, 4-0. It was a four-point rule. And that was originally kind of one of those programs that was started because biologists were talking about protecting an age class and getting to the next age class. And then politicians heard it and said, okay, how do we do that? Well, we need an antler restriction. 4 points will do it. Yes, I'll do it. And that's basically about how it passed and about how fast all that went around. So fast forward 10 years to about 2004, we were talking with hunters and we heard from the public through our DMAP program, our Deer Management Assistance Program across the state, some complaints about deer size and antler quality, body size, like you mentioned, from the lower coastal plain and southern part of Mississippi on up through the center part of the state and the hills and then into the Delta, where people were always wanting to have deer from the Delta because they're so much bigger. Body weights are so much bigger. Record deer are coming from those areas. So that's where everybody thought that they needed to get deer from. And they were, it was kind of thought that they could go trap one deer from, Madison County, which is not actually in the Delta, but it's in a really fertile part of the Mississippi along the Big Black River in central Mississippi. They could trap one deer from Madison County or take one deer from on the Mississippi River, drop it off in a county in southeast Mississippi and change the genetics of the herd in that county.
Boone and Crockett's everywhere.
Boone and Crockett's everywhere, exactly. You take one of those bucks and you put it in the county and change the genetics. And I actually heard that exact thing being said multiple times from multiple different people. Some that were very educated really thought that they could do that and they could change the genetic structure of a deer population by moving deer around the state. It was seen, they even thought that in some other states in the South, where that was a project that almost got out underway in some projects where they were going to be, distributing deer across the state. Biologists with our agency and biologists not only with the agency but in Mississippi, for a long time we thought we knew that it was not a genetic issue in Mississippi, that we had good genetics in Mississippi. There had been research projects done in the past that looked at the genetic makeup across the state, where the deer originated. And we had deer that were introduced from Mexico, Virginia, Michigan, Wisconsin, all over the place that came into a couple of different places in Mississippi and then were redistributed out across the state. A lot of deer were swapped between Mississippi and Alabama back during the restocking era. And when we're talking about the restocking, we're going back, starting in the 50s and really going all the way up through the 70s into the 80s. It really wasn't as much into the 80s, mostly into the 70s, when these deer were restocked across the state. And so we didn't feel like there was a genetic problem. We said it had to do with soil nutrition or nutrition and what the deer could eat. And I know y'all talked about what the deer eat a couple of weeks ago on the podcast. And we had looked at plants and we looked at plant makeup in different parts of the state. And we saw that plants in Delta areas with high fertile soils, the plants were in better condition. The plants had more protein. And so it just kind of all made sense if, one plus one equals two kind of thing. But yet we had never proved it, had never been able to show the public, here is the research, here is the results of that research. And so that's kind of how this project was born, was to look at whether or not it was genetic problems or genetic differences across the state, not necessarily a problem, but genetic differences across the state, or whether it was nutrition and the environment that was causing deer to be smaller in South Mississippi and larger in the Delta.
So, Chad, what you spoke about there is what we commonly think of as biologists is phenotype. Mm-hmm. And phenotype is the expression of an animal, in this case deer, an expression of their genes. And for an animal to fully express their genetics, the environment is very, very important. In this case, food. So what you were representing, like all of us, all the biologists, we were sitting back thinking, good grief, it's nutrition.
Right.
You got a place where we have big deer. Coincidentally, the landscape is composed of soybeans and corn. We've got a region of the state where the deer are a lot smaller. There's not hardly any food there because of the way the landscape is managed. So we're sitting back thinking, this may be a pretty big waste of time, but from the agency's perspective and a research perspective, let's prove it.
It was an important question, right? It was a very important question to document, get those actual results back, because, like you said, we all thought we knew what was the results were going to be. But when you were able to do that and you're able to prove something like that, it gives the biologist a lot more credit. It gives the state agency a lot more credit. It gives the university a lot more credit, because now when we go talk about these things, we can reference an actual, you know, research project that has been peer-reviewed, that has been evaluated, that's not something that was done internally.
Right, right. So enter Steve Damaris about 10 years ago.
Yeah, so... You know, these early projects, looking at the soils and the plants, those were what we call associational projects. There was an association between the soil quality and the plants, and there was an association between the plant quality and the body weights and the antler size differences. But, you know, an association doesn't prove. I mean, just because we're sitting next to each other in this room doesn't mean we're related.
That's right.
And so we're, you know, it's just association.
Aren't you glad, Chad? Yeah, well, you know.
Yeah. So anyway, what we needed to address the big question that the agency couldn't say we have proof, and the university couldn't say we have proof. We needed to prove it, that there was not a genetic limitation.
Right.
And really, 50, 60 years ago, when the different subspecies of whitetails were described, you know, academicians just looking at morphology or the physical characteristics of deer, studying in their, you know, little white tower somewhere, said there are certain subspecies around the southeast, and one of them was the what they call the Osceola or the Florida white-tailed deer. And that range comes into southern Mississippi. And there, that subspecies was described because it was a smaller-bodied animal. And then much of Mississippi contains the Virginia subspecies of the white-tailed deer. And so, you know, if someone wanted to go to court, sue the agency and say, we have to bring in deer because they are genetically restricted in this area, and we need to fix this problem. It's been documented. Scientists have written about this. And so there's the proof. But that doesn't mean that there was a genetic difference. Genetics wasn't researched back in those days. It was just measuring antler size and body weights and skull measurements and things like that. So,
is that what you mean by morphology? Make sure you clarify that.
Yeah, morphology, the physical makeup of the animals.
So taxonomists back in the day were taking physical measurements, the size, the body weight, et cetera, and then concluded, without, of course, you didn't even have DNA tests back then, but concluded it was a different subspecies.
Yeah.
Just because of the size.
And back to your earlier term, phenotype, you know, they made subspecies designations based on phenotype, not genetics. And again, phenotype is genetics as affected by the environment. And so what we needed to do is tease apart that. We needed to control for the environment to look, is there a real genetic difference? And the only way to do that is with a controlled study. It's not associational. We have three gene pools that are treated the same way environmentally. And by environment, we mean, you know, how they're raised and the conditions under which they're raised, and in particular, nutrition. We needed to remove that, what I thought at the time, too, was it was a nutritional difference between these regions. But we didn't have proof. So we had to control for that. And then the remaining feature would be genetics. And the idea was if we control for nutrition and have these populations in the same with the same nutrition, being raised in the same environment at the same age, they should, if there's no genetic difference, they should compensate and be the same body size at some point in time.
So let's review that, Steve. If we remove, and in this case, when we say environment, for this purpose, we're talking nutrition. Environment can be a lot of stuff in the wild, but the one thing we wanted to control was nutrition.
Yes, and they were literally in the same environment in terms of research pens.
Right.
They were all in the same location.
So how did you start the project? We don't need to get in the weeds of the statistical design and all that stuff, In terms of how did you begin the project, as well as MDWFMP, I remember y'all.
I'll never forget that moment when we were at a deer meeting at one of our. We had annual meetings every year where all of our staff would get together, and I remember Steve coming in and talking to us about this project, and we all just kind of looked at each other like, "There's no way, this is impossible. What they're asking us to do at this point." This is not going to happen. This is an impossible task. And we were told that it would happen, that it was an agency priority. And if it was not for the people that work for Mississippi Department of Wildlife, Fisheries, and Parks, from the wildlife area managers, the conservation officers, to the biologists, all working together as one group with the researchers and the grad students at Mississippi State, there's no way this project could have been pulled off.
It was a monumental undertaking. That's an understatement.
That is an understatement.
Monumental
yes.
undertaking.
Yeah, I remember your supervisor at that point, Larry Castle, saying, "This is going to rock your world."
Yes, he did.
And it rocked your world for
did.
2
yep,
years.
It did.
Yeah.
Because what we had to do, what the agency had to do for us as researchers, we needed to capture the genetic characteristics of an entire region of deer. The entire lower coastal plain, the area with the smallest body and antler size, the thin lurse, which is a region of Mississippi that has middle-sized antlers and body weights, and then the delta or the alluvial valley along the Mississippi River had our better sized deer. We had to capture the genetics from each of those three regions, bring them into the same environment, feed them the same. And you don't just go and pick up 5 deer from one place. You sample the region. And so it rocked the agency's world and was an amazing feat by the biologists and the area managers and the game wardens. And yeah,
it was one of those things that, you know, we all, when we were dreading doing it, but now looking back on it, not only we got all of us that worked on it, we can say we worked on this project,
yeah,
but being able to look back on it and realize that the project was actually a success from being able to capture all those deer and be able to do all this research, it was an unbelievable 10 plus year adventure.
Yes, it was. In fact, this is more social than science here, but remember we had the after each capture season we had the awards banquet, and we'd give out awards for, like, I remember Jim Wilcutt got the stump sitter award because he spent the most hours out on a stand trying to capture deer, and then you got an award for shooting a buck in the testicles or something.
I got a shot placement award. Yeah, sure did. Got
it was a windy day. I'm
it was
sure.
a windy day. Yeah, yeah. You know, you had to use a little Kentucky windage on the shot. You know, but it was. We had a lot of fun doing it. We had put some PowerPoint presentations together. There were thousands of photographs that we took of you know, trying to document everything that was going on. But it was a monumental undertaking that couldn't have been done without the men and women of Mississippi Department of Wildlife, Fisheries, and Parks.
Why don't y'all tell everybody what you had to do?
Well,
so tell me about the deer.
Okay,
how'd
sure.
you get them?
Well, the agency organized crews, work capture crews, that went literally to a region and worked out of a state WMA for a week at a time, and captured deer at different locations across that region. And by capturing deer, we're talking about capturing bred adult does. We wanted does, you know, bringing fawns to us, basically. Let the fawns be produced in our controlled environment and then raised up. You know, so fawns raised up on optimum nutrition in the same environment should be expressing the same potential if they have the same genes. Now, those fawns produced by the wild captured deer were what we call the first generation. And there'd been some research in wildlife sciences that showed what we call maternal effects, so that it was actually the first stuff was done up in Michigan, showing that a bad winter carried over for a couple of generations from a female to her offspring, and even onto her offspring if there was a bad winter. And so this
and you know, it makes a lot of sense if you think about it. And if you think about it in a real simple term, whatever the mother's condition is, when whatever the mother is, whatever animal we're talking about, whether we're talking about humans or whether we're talking about animals, whatever condition that mother is in, their child, it is very dependent on what condition the mother is from what their condition is. So if a mother is in poor health, living in bad conditions, then that child is going to maybe smaller in weight, may not grow as fast, may not develop as fast than one that is in prime condition, that is, you know, living in the laps of luxury kind of thing. Their offspring or their children are going to be in much better condition and have the potential of growing to their fullest ability.
Yeah, and that brings back a good point. The habitats in the lower coastal plain that these deer have been living under for generations and generations were poor quality habitats. And so it could also be argued that the populations of deer living under those conditions had genetically adapted to being smaller, because it's not advantageous to try to grow big if you can't support that body size. And so, you know, that's part of that argument that, well, maybe there is a genetic difference. These lower coastal plain deer are just, they're genetically programmed to be small because for generations and generations, that's all they've had to deal with.
Yeah, the biological term would be adaptive. It would be adaptive for them to have a smaller body. So, Steve, why don't you characterize those so people know what was different about the lower coastal plain? So our delta region, we've already mentioned, had an abundance of food because of agriculture. So we're already dealing with fertile soils. We're already dealing with soils that produce a whole bunch of deer plants. We called it forbs in the last episode. But then we also have agriculture to augment that. Now, the complete opposite would be the lower coastal plain. And you did a lot of research in the lower coastal plain years ago.
Yeah, in the lower coastal plain, you're talking about a sandier soils that are well-drained, so when it rains, the water just goes through. If you think about sand at a beach, pour water on the sand, it just goes right through. You go to a heavier clay soil like you find in the delta along the river, pour water on it, it just stands on there and soaks in and then stays wet for days.
Or think about it this way. Think about from what you use in your flower beds, you know, for potting soil. It holds moisture. That's why you can grow plants, and just about anybody can grow a plant in some potting soil. So the soils are better, and they're, you know, that's the big difference of what we saw in the Delta region versus the lower coastal plain from a complete layman's view. You know, there's the dirt is different.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then that dirt pretty much determines what people are going to use the region for. And in the Delta, it's agriculture, because the best soils are what the farmers tend to grow on.
You're not going to make a living trying to get high yields of soybeans in those types of soils.
No.
So the alternative?
Grow pine trees. And timber management, you know, intensive pine plantation management is the dominant land use. Timber management is the dominant land use in the lower coastal plain. And there are times when that can be very effectively managed for deer forage, but there are other times when it can't be. And so across the landscape, you have a lower carrying capacity nutritionally for deer. And so between the soil quality and the land use, you've got a lower coastal plain region that doesn't have good nutrition generally.
So you're dealing with populations of deer that generation after generation, decade after decade, they've had to deal with a lower abundance of deer food and lower quality deer food.
That's right. And those nutritional differences and or genetics, you know, prior to this research project, we couldn't say it wasn't genetics, resulted in some major differences in the antler size of harvested bucks. And, you know, the state agency has a great program called the Deer Management Assistance Program, and the data from that we get, and we get to do research on it. And we found that the lower coastal plain mature buck, average mature buck in the lower coastal plain, gross Boone and Crockett score is 116 inches. The thin lurse was about 126 inches. And the delta, or alluvial plains, 136 inches. So there's a 10-inch difference between the three regions, and then 20 difference between the low and the high. So that's a huge difference. If you're a hunter and you are shooting 116s and your buddies are shooting 136s, that's a big difference.
It's a big difference.
So as a landowner, you know, I could see somebody complaining. You know, I want bigger deer, and it's always easy to look out for a cause of a problem as opposed to looking in. But, you know, some landowners say, we have a genetics problem. State agency, fix this for us. Let us bring in some big deer.
And that's what a lot of the landowners and the hunters thought would be a quick fix. That's what some people saw as being a quick fix, that it was a genetic problem. We can fix it, and we can fix it fast.
The diet pill answer.
Exactly, yeah. Right. That's exactly
Take
right.
Take a diet pill, turn a couple bucks loose, and now you've got Boone and Crockett.
That's exactly
150s
right.
running around right. everywhere. Mm-hmm. So, Steve, you got this project going, and graduate students as well.
Absolutely.
You know, some
fine graduate students.
Many wonderful graduate students helped out with this. Explain for everybody again kind of the experiment now, the process by which. So you brought pregnant does. That was what MDWFMP and students and yourself in the field, you captured pregnant does. And then they were all brought back to the MSU Deer Facility to have their fawns. And the study is about the fawn. So mother's out of the study right now, essentially.
Yeah, she produces her fawn, and then we raise the fawn up on optimum nutrition after they're weaned. So the buck fawns, doe fawns are weaned, and then they start eating the optimum nutrition. And in our research facility, that meant a combination of planted forages in the pens, but also a pelleted full ration diet. It was a high quality forage. We wanted to eliminate any concern that there was a nutritional limitation.
So experimentally, that is what you're controlling for and you're isolating. So now every deer has the exact same diet. So from once it has been weaned from its mother, every single buck fawn that came from the lower coastal plain or from the delta and the Lurse Hills in between, they all had access to the exact same diet, and you started measuring bodies and antlers when? Starting at year one? Or?
Well, we started measuring bodies at birth. We found the fawns within a day of birth, tagged them, measured them, and then tagged. Once they're, you know, when they're born, they're hiders, and you can just walk up and pick them up. They're really easy to capture within a day or two, but after that, they're, you know, it's game on as far as capturing them. And so at 6 months of age, we'd dart them and take body measurements. At 1.5 years of age, we'd dart them. And when I say dart, we'd use a dart rifle to shoot a projectile that contained a chemical drug combination, and that would sedate them, knock them out, and we'd weigh them, cut their antlers off, measure the antlers, and collect our data. And so we did that each year for 3 years of their lives. and took a couple of years to generate enough what we call these F1s, these fawns from wild deer. And then we raised the F1s up, that first generation, on good nutrition, and let them produce offspring. And then we raised that second generation up on good nutrition. So what we've done is we've taken the wild genetics and removed the environmental variation, habitat quality, and controlled that for two generations. And if there's a genetic difference, they should stay different. And if there's not a genetic difference, then they should compensate. And so we were, you know, our hypothesis as biologists was what we'd been saying all along: this is a nutritional difference, it's not genetics, and they will compensate and get just as big. The bucks out of the lower coastal plain will grow antlers just as big as the Delta bucks.
By compensate, you mean make up for?
Make up for, yes.
The bucks in the lower coastal plain region, for example, should now have antlers equal to that from the Delta.
Yes.
They have compensated for the lack of nutrition,
yes,
and then made up for it.
Yes, and you know, one of the interesting things, right from the very beginning, there wasn't much variation in fawn weights. When they're born, the fawns from the Delta does was about the same size as the fawns from the lower coastal plain and the Lurse Hills. At that point in their lives, they're pretty much equal. So it's their growth rate that is potentially being affected by nutrition. And later on in this podcast, we'll talk about how that growth rate might have been altered. That's a really cool part of this study, but
sure,
let's
is.
Talk about the study first.
Okay, so what did you find, Steve, after, let's remind everybody, first generation, because we're going to keep using these terms. I want to make sure everyone's clear. We use the term F1, we use the term first generation. That's the same thing.
Yes.
The first generation means that their mother was in the wild.
Yes.
They were born from a mother in the wild. The F2, or the second generation, means their mother was raised in captivity and raised on good nutrition.
That's right. And their father.
So, and their father.
Going back to the wild captured deer, you know, those fawns were sired by wild deer living in their regions. Mm-hmm. So they had that first generation fawn was sired by both parents that were wild deer living in their original source region. And that's important. And so the first generation buck fawns and doe fawns raised on optimum nutrition. And what we were most interested in was the buck response. So we weighed, measured bucks through 3 years of age, and we were underwhelmed with some of the responses we got with that first generation. We did see some benefits. We, for example, in the body weights, the Delta bucks bumped up 9 pounds at 3 years of age. The Lurse Hill bucks bumped up 9 pounds. The lower coastal plain bucks, they bumped up a couple of pounds compared to harvested bucks the same age from their regions. So we saw a little bit of a body response, not as much as maybe I would have thought, and really I was hoping for the lower coastal plain to jump out and start compensating, and they had the actual smallest response.
Yeah, Steve, that speaks volumes right there, even beyond the topic at hand here. So let's make sure people understand that. Compared to 3.5-year-old bucks raised in the environment that we just previously described, food quality is low, food abundance is low. Now you have these buck fawns that were raised in the research facility, and from the time they were weaned until 3.5 years of age, they had high quality food, all they wanted to eat.
Absolutely.
Did you only feed them a handful of food?
No, no. To use a little Latin on you, ad libitum means as much as they want.
Kind of like you at the ice cream bar.
Yes.
As much as you want.
Yes.
So these bucks that grew up with as much as they want, and they weighed 2 pounds more than the free-ranging wild deer.
Yes.
How do you explain that, Steve?
Well, I was stumbling a little bit with my explanation at that point, but I fell back on the concept that I had, well, expressed from the beginning, is that it takes two generations. It's going to take two generations. We weren't expecting an immediate response. We got to wait. And that's why it was a 10-year project. We got to wait. I waited a long time for that second generation to come back around. But before we get to the second generation, first generation antlers. Antlers bumped up a little bit, 5 to 7 inches in the Lerse Hills. And we actually had a bigger bump in the Lower Coastal Plain.
What was the increase there?
7 inches.
So it increased, but that's not what people are thinking when you want to bring a couple big delta bucks loose and turn them loose down the Lower Coastal Plain.
That's right.
That's not that impressive.
No. So I was out on thin ice at this point, but theoretically the ice was thick.
Let me tell you from behind the scenes, Steve. There were a lot of people thinking there may be something to this genetic. There may be the Lower Coastal Plain, as you described earlier, generation after generation. Maybe there is a genetic consequence. Maybe they've lived in isolation for long enough. Maybe the environment has been enough of a selective pressure to only allow genotypes that produce small deer. Think about the key deer in mm-hmm. Florida. Those deer aren't much bigger than a puppy dog in a lot of places.
And I'd love to get them in an experiment like this, too.
Ooh, what the... Well, when they're not an endangered species, we might have some freedom to test that.
Right.
But
we could make them a non-endangered species by feeding them optimum nutrition for about 10 generations, and they'd be as big as our deer here, and we wouldn't have an endangered species anymore.
Okay, send your letters to Steve Damaris.
And opinions expressed on this broadcast are not those of Mississippi State University or the Department of Wildlife and Fisheries.
Or Bronson Strickland, for that matter.
That's right.
Okay, so Steve, you found underwhelming response.
Yes.
So there was a little bit, there were gains, I guess, in both antlers as well as body weight, but very pedestrian, very underwhelming. Frankly, I remember being disappointed and shocked, and I was probably disappointed because I thought, my goodness, my hypothesis going into this, that it was all nutrition, I may have been wrong, and I've got a lot of crow to eat. Chad's going to have a lot of crow to eat.
I can remember when these first results started to come in, and we were putting together just some real simple picture books so you could visually see differences, and we weren't seeing big, huge differences. And we started hearing that comment, and then we had to hold on. We said this was going to take two, really needed probably three generations to really start to show some results. So let's wait a second. Let's not get into the results yet. Let's wait. Let's go through this next iteration. Get into the second generation and start to see what the results show then.
It's kind of like listening to Bronson's first podcast. I mean, some of the listeners might have thought, I don't know about this. I'm underwhelmed by this first broadcast. But luckily, enough of them have hung around, and I think people are actually listening now.
I might add, Steve, that luckily I edit the sound file. So I may just edit that right out.
Okay.
But carry on.
Yes. So we had underwhelming results from the first generation. Nutrition didn't have the big bang effect that we would hoped for. But we were committed to two generations. So those first generation animals that had been raised on nutrition, good nutrition, were allowed to breed within their region. So Lower Coastal Plain bucks breed Lower Coastal Plain does produce fawns within our pens. We raise those up. Now it gets really interesting. Now it's like, I can walk down the street in Jackson and not have to worry about getting something thrown at me. Second generation.
He still can't walk through Starkville.
That's because of all my former students on the street, but that's another story. Lower Coastal Plain bucks, those bucks that only added 2 pounds in that first generation, second generation were 36 pounds heavier. now we're talking some serious impact.
We went from underwhelming to overwhelming.
Yes.
35, 36-pound difference. That's incredible.
And they added 28 inches of Boone and Crockett score. This is at 3 years of age.
Now you just got a hunter's attention.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's more than the difference originally between mature bucks in the lower coastal plain and mature bucks in the Delta.
That was 20 inches
that was 20.
In the wild.
We've just added 28 inches just to three-year-olds with two generations of good nutrition.
Why, Steve, why did it take two generations? Why do you think it took two generations?
Well, I think it comes down to a relatively new area of science called there's genetics, and then there's this new area of genetics called epigenetics. And our genes are full of an amazing genetic makeup. All animals are. And what it appears is that some genes are turned off and on, and so they don't necessarily go away. They're just turned off, and they're still kind of operating in the background. And I think what's happened here is it took two generations for the genetic switches to get turned on. So those deer in the lower coastal plain that have been living for generation after generation after generation with low quality habitat had turned their switches off. And so in a way there was a genetic effect from the environment, but it was an epigenetic, which is a not permanent genetic trait. It's a flexible genetic trait. And so bringing the deer into the same environment, the same nutrition, started turning the switches on in the first generation, but they didn't all get turned on. I mean, think about it from an adaptive standpoint. If you're a deer, and you know, deer aren't thinking about it, but just from an ecologically adaptive standpoint, if you have a couple of years of really good environmental conditions in the lower coastal plain and there's some good food because something happened and the habitat was good for a couple of years, you don't necessarily need to start growing big right away, because if it goes back to the poor habitat in a couple of years, you're hosed. You're in trouble, because you've grown, you've invested immediately in good food, and you're now big. And big doesn't survive well when you're eating low-quality food.
Yeah, hopefully that'll make sense to everybody. If there's a finite amount of either food or food quality on the landscape, those that survive better are going to be smaller. It's a lot easier for a smaller animal to meet their physiological demands with less food. And then the bigger you are, the greater the mismatch between your body size and food resources, the worse off you're going to be.
That's right. Yeah, if you go to an all-you-can-eat buffet line around here, and you're, say you, for instance, Bronson, you go in and you're just going to pick a little bit at the salad bar. Well, Chad goes in the same buffet line, he's heading to the ribs and the steaks, but if the place only has salad, Chad's in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also, if we think about it this way too, from the example I used earlier of like potting soil in your garden, think about it this way too, how you can have a boom if you continue to water your garden all summer long. And anything that's come, you're harvesting the fruit off of your vegetables and the of all of your labor because you've had an increase in rainfall. Well, like what Steve was saying, if you have two years of very high rainfall events, your quality of your vegetation is going to be more. There's going to be more abundant vegetation that grows in the wild. And then if you go through a period of 3 years of drought, you don't want to have expended all of your energy to grow big during those 2 years of high rainfall events, because then you're going to suffer even harder consequences during those years of drought after that.
Yeah, you've got more tissue to sustain.
Right.
And when the resource isn't limited, great. But when the resources are limited, it can cost you your life.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's why I think the lower coastal plain deer were underwhelming that first generation, because it was not in their best interest to invest in bigger bodies. They had to be convinced, their genes had to be convinced that, hey, this is a long-term benefit. We better take advantage, because there are obvious benefits to being bigger when you can sustain it.
So this also could answer the question about some of these areas in the lower coastal plain that tend to have better deer production year after year and better quality animals coming off of them. They may also have better habitat than what their neighbors have, and they may be doing habitat work, and they may have better vegetation than what their neighbors do. And that could be a reason for that great differences that we see sometimes down in the lower coastal plain as well.
Yeah, within the lower coastal plain, there are pockets of well-managed habitat, mm-hmm. and those properties are producing good deer.
Mm-hmm. We've seen that analytically as well, not to get in the stats weeds too far here, but Chad, it shows that when we look at variability, you know, like say in Boone and Crockett score, variability, how much does it range from top to bottom? It ranges the greatest in the lower coastal plain. So a little can also go a long way down there. If you've got really, really poor conditions, adding something to it can cause improvement. But you reach a point of, like in the Delta, potentially diminishing returns. Mm-hmm. One more soybean plant isn't going to help right. any more deer in the Delta. So we call that more homogenous. Populations are more homogenous. They're all better, and they're all kind of uniformly better, but they're a lot more variable down south. And it's probably, yeah, due to nutrition and the way resources are and the way management styles might differ
yes.
so much.
And the thing to the really the home take-home message from this project, I'm sorry if I'm jumping ahead. You were probably about to segue into this. But the thing to keep in mind for managers is generational improvements. Mm-hmm. We're not managing habitat for a couple of years. You don't go out and have, there's no quick fix, there's no diet pill for deer. It comes down to fixing the habitat limitations for generations of deer before you can expect to see the real big return on investment.
What do you call, so give a time scale to somebody. What's a couple deer generations to people?
Minimally, it's a generation is 3 years. For a fawn to grow up, reach maturity, and be able to produce young, we're talking 3 years. And so the second generation is another 3 years. And really, you know, we're talking about reaching full maturity from that second generation. So we're talking, you know, almost 10 years. That's why it took us 10 years to do this study. It takes a while to generate generations of deer and then to have them grow through full maturity, which is 6 years of age. You know, you're talking about a 10-year investment.
It's a long-term investment in not only habitat management, but also deer herd management and deer herd health. When you're managing for deer populations, there is no quick fix. There is nothing you can do today that will affect your season this coming up season that's going to increase by 10 inches of antler score. There's nothing you can do this summer that's going to make your deer population be that much better this coming up year. But you can start working on things today that over the course of the time that you manage a property, over the next generations, that you're going to improve the quality of the hunting quality, you're going to improve deer quality, you're going to improve the quality of that entire landscape.
Well, Steve, you did steal my thunder a little bit.
I'm sorry.
I was about to wrap it up with that, with kind of management implications. So let's delve a little bit further into that.
Before we do that, though, I'm going to complain about you.
You're calling me out.
Yes. I was planning on trying some diet pills, and now you tell me they don't work.
Go right ahead. Yeah.
Shoot.
But we'll see you next year, and we'll see if it's any different.
Okay. But go ahead. I'm sorry. I jest.
One of the things, we have all heard this more times than we care to remember. This is just an example. So let's talk about someone that wants to incorporate a supplemental feeding program. Now, Steve, what you just said is we had a cohort of 3.5-year-old bucks that lived their entire life eating supplemental feed, high quality, all they could cram in their stomach whenever they wanted. And we affected body weight by a couple pounds and affected antler size by 7 inches compared to the wild deer where they were from. How do you guys think that on a property from 500 to 2,500 acres, and you go out there for a few months out of the year and have a supplemental feeder, how much are you going to impact your deer herd with that?
Me? I think they're wasting the money. They're wasting their time. They're wasting their effort. It makes us feel good to do that. I don't think that the long-term benefit that you're going to get to that deer herd, to that specific animal, to increase antler score is going to be there. There's been a lot of research that was done in Texas. I can remember a few years ago at the deer study group meeting, one of the guys from Texas that talked about, you know, he had an unlimited pocketbook, and the numbers that he was throwing out on the number, he had no idea how much money he was spending on feed. But he also knew that his deer were living on it. And that's the only thing that they were living on. They didn't have habitat to fall back on. He also knew if he quit, that he would have no more deer. So I think that when people feed for, you know, have a couple feeders on a property and they're putting feed in it 2 or 3 months a year, yeah, there's deer getting some use out of it. But from a herd benefit, from a health benefit, I don't think there's as great of a benefit as there would be if you started doing some long-term habitat management projects on those properties and started setting back succession on some of those areas that are not high-quality foods. They're not producing high-quality foods. It's all shaded out. Start doing some small habitat work like that on the property. Those are going to sustain for a lot longer period, not only through the year, but over a lifetime, over a generation, than throwing out a couple sacks of feed every year.
So if you put out that much, I mean, to me that tells the story on the short term with me. You had these bucks raised for 3 years with all the supplemental feed they could possibly consume, and they increased a couple pounds,
yeah,
and a couple inches. But it took the long-term return of mother. So I try to tell people, too, that, and this can even apply to habitat management. I mean, you're always trying to improve, and it could be food plots and things like that as well. But you're never going to see the big jump in deer in the short term. So when you improve nutrition on the landscape, you're going to improve diet quality a little bit, and some deer are going to respond a little bit. But you're never going to flip the switch, so to speak, with that buck that's already living on the ground. It's almost like, to me, the die has already been cast. Mm-hmm. His phenotype, when he grows up, has already been set. And then you influence it a little bit more with food, mm-hmm, maybe by a few inches here or there, a few pounds here or there. But where you make these monumental shifts is mother.
Yes.
Mother has, for year after year, mother needs to be in good condition, and then raising her fawns in good condition, and that's where you see the changes. Does everybody agree that might be a good note to end up on? Mm-hmm. Anything else, Steve?
Well, it's a frustrating note for many because our society is now an instant gratification society, and we want to be able to, you know, download something immediately. We're on your phone and, oh, it's taken 3 seconds to download. This is a frustrating situation. And that's not how deer management goes. It's a generational investment. Talking, you know, when you manage the habitat, again, you're investing in the offspring of the mothers that are on that property, not the deer that are on that property.
You're investing in the offspring of that mother, and then you got to allow those offspring to grow to maturity.
That's right.
So, I mean, just right off the bat, when you do these things, if you're really going to have an impact, you're on a five-year time scale before you really start seeing these changes manifested.
Absolutely.
And another thing, it just kind of end up on, people are not going to see that benefit if they don't collect data on their property. If they're not collecting harvest data, if they're not collecting weight and age data, they're not going to know whether they're having an impact or not. They've got to collect data.
Always have to collect data. You can't manage what you don't measure.
Hey, that sounds like a great...
You've heard that before, haven't
you? That's a great saying.
Yeah. All right, guys. Well, I think we'll wrap up there. We're going to have a part two to this episode. We're going to call our former student, Eric Mitchell. And he devoted quite a few years to this project. And we're going to talk about his take on it and get a little more insight from his perspective.
So you're going to talk to the guy that did all the work, basically.
We're going to talk to the brains of the operation, Steve.
Yeah.
The one that made us all look good.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, actually, and Eric did. Let's mention some of the other graduate students. Amy Blaylock.
Yep.
Mike Dye.
Jeremy Flynn.
Emily.
Emily Flynn. They got married after they came here, fell in love. It was another productive product of ours. So we've impacted, they now have two children. So there's a genetic F1 generation that's the result of that project. And that, I'm sorry, I'm rambling. You can cut this part out.
Don't worry. All right, everyone. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll talk more about this this project between genetics and environment and how it's changing. We hope that it's changing deer management in Mississippi and throughout the U.S. We're glad you joined us today and hope you learned something valuable about deer management. If you have questions about this podcast or a question about a topic we haven't discussed, please log on to msudeerlab.com, click on the Deer University tab, and send us your questions. We'll get to them as soon as possible. In closing, we want to thank our employers, the Mississippi State University Extension Service and the Forest and Wildlife Research Center. We also want to thank the St. John and Dudley Hutchinson families for their endowments that support deer research and education.